Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today's show features Paul Rosenberg, who is a lifestyle capitalist. He has a broad range of interests and experiences, and most notably, he's written 3 novels and 55 engineering books. He also has been recruited as a consultant by NASA and the U.S. military and other high-profile organizations. He has developed and taught over 19 courses at the Iowa State University's College of Engineering, and he was the first to standardize the installation of fiber optic cables. And today he's going to join us to talk about what the reality is in our country right now. And he has a really positive, fresh perspective on all this. So it's a really interesting conversation. But before we get into that, we're going to be joined by Joel Miller, who is an expert on leadership coaching. She developed a leadership coaching system that has been used by thousands of top executives. And she's going to share with us some of the tips that she shares with executives around the country. So for now, let's welcome Joel Miller. Hi, Joel. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sarah.
You have a leadership coaching system that you've literally had thousands of people work through. What is your coaching system?
Thanks for asking. So my expertise over the past 15 years has been around helping emerging women leaders advance to their next level of management or leadership or technical expertise in their career. And so after many, many conversations with women who hope to advance their careers, I was able to really narrow down to what are the core set of competencies that when emerging leaders build those skills, their careers start to advance more rapidly. So interestingly enough, one of those is having a positive way to deal with office politics. And another is building an influential network around you, a network that supports you in your most important career and leadership goals. And from there, the system goes on step by step through things like understanding your ideal niche in your career or in the business that you're in and knowing how to brand that and communicate it effectively. And finally, having some influencing skills. So this is one that I teach many times a year nationally and internationally.
Sure.
The groups, the workshops, webinars, and other coaching programs.
Well, how does that differ from what men need? Is it pretty similar?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And so my research was really based around women and their careers. And so I can really stand by that these are the skills that women need to build in order to advance. But what I'm finding more and more as I get out and speak to various groups is that, these skills tend to work for men as well.
Yeah, it's kind of it works for leaders. What obstacles do they have that men don't have? Or do they have the same obstacles, it's just projected differently?
You know, that's interesting, and I think you nailed it. It's often the same obstacles, but they get experienced or projected differently. So one of the things that we're hearing a lot about right now in the leadership world and in the media at large is unconscious bias, which women and people from other minority groups really deal with in a much more more enhanced way than men would need to. What I find from my own research and the people that I've coached and supported is that the skills are pretty much the same, but women might need to go about it just a little differently or just be a whole lot more diligent with applying those skills.
Well, if there's an unconscious bias, men actually can benefit from an unconscious bias the other way, right? They walk in and the room and people think they're automatically competent. Does that go on as well?
Yeah, it does. It does. And so hence, I think one of the reasons that we're seeing, some resistance or maybe just, we'll see, say, male executives get up at a women's leadership conference and say something like, if you just work hard and put your head down and apply yourself, all of these career rewards will come. And it's absolutely true. It's just that it's true for them. It's not necessarily true for the women that are their audience and that are their employees.
Because they have that positive bias towards them. So if they just work hard, it'll come for them. But women that just work hard, it doesn't necessarily just come.
Yeah, that's right. And so I see a lot of women that feel like they are the best kept secret in their organization. They work hard, they put their head down, they deliver phenomenal results to their organization, but for whatever reason, they just don't seem to get recognized in the same way that perhaps their male peers do.
Well, don't you think that's just a really good business opportunity? It's kind of like if you're going to invest in a business, it's the business that's the stock that's going to go up because it's undervalued. As a good business leader, you want to identify those gems because those are the ones that really can help your business move forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. I think every business has those hidden gems that, you know, that best kept secret in the organization just waiting to be recognized. So we have this untapped, maybe undervalued asset. And, you know, every good business person should know to look out for those and tap into them.
And sometimes they just need a little bit of support and a little bit of positive communication and they can just flourish.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right. And you know, having some influential sponsors can really make a difference. So look around for who in the organization is that influential leader who's a great talent scout and talent developer and see if you can, you know, make your career goals and your accomplishments known to that person. And you may just get one of those great leaders who's climbing the ladder, but pulling you up along with them.
Yeah. So it's good to surround yourself with really good people.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Right. And positive people.
Yeah, definitely. Surround yourself with your dream team. And I think it's a really important competency for established senior leaders to be a great talent developer and talent scout and be bringing others up along with you. But, you know, you don't just have to wait until you're more senior in your career. You can be a sponsor to someone else at any other time as long as you have a little influence and can pull some strings to expose that person to opportunities that they might not have otherwise. So I say, you know, be a lifelong mentor and sponsor and talent scout and figure out your dream team early on in your career, those people who are your business soulmates, so to speak, and you know, watch your careers rise along with each other.
And you shouldn't be fearful to have people who are better than you around you, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think there's this great quote from Michael Dell that I'll probably mangle, but it was something like, you know, if you feel like you're the smartest person in the room, you need to find a different room.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, you don't want to be the smartest person in the room. You're not tapping into the excellence and the brilliance of others.
That's not good. Exactly. Well, you're not going to get better if you're just I always say the energy of the room equalizes. So I suppose that goes with the thoughts of the room too. So they're going to bring you down a little bit if all you do is hang out with people that are not as smart as you.
And
that's not I'm not saying don't hang out with people that aren't, or don't associate with others, but hopefully our audience understands what I'm saying here.
Yes, yeah, and again, I don't know exactly what the source was, but there's this great idea that we become sort of the average of the 10 people we surround
exactly.
ourselves with. You know, those social networks are so important and so powerful. So it's great to surround yourself with people that challenge you and challenge your ways of thinking. And I think it kind of brings us full circle back to our diversity and our unconscious bias piece that, you know, you want to be bringing out the best in others around you because ultimately you're going to be a stronger, more effective leader yourself.
Well, you mentioned office politics. What do you do with, you know, and that's about making sure in a positive environment as well, but you can't get around the office politics. How do you deal with that?
You absolutely can't get around it. I think one of the greatest mistakes that up and coming leaders make is they think they can stick their head in the sand and ignore it. And you really can't. You can try and ignore office politics and hope it goes away. But it'll come back and get you. And so you really need some positive skills to deal with it in a healthy and effective way. And by the way, I don't think anyone jumps out of bed every morning and says, you know what I want to do today? I want to win at office politics. And I don't think MBA programs teach it. And yet it's this really undervalued leadership skill or potential derailer. If we don't pay attention to it, it has the potential to completely derail you in your career.
But what do you do? What do you do with that vindictive person that just does not like you, and it's they don't make it very obvious. Everyone else thinks that, or most people think they're very nice because they treat you differently, and they're just very vindictive and they're trying to take you down. What do you do?
I think the first thing to know is that you don't have to turn into that person yourself. And so one of the reasons I see a lot of people, especially women, holding back from engaging in office politics at all is because they never want to turn into that person. And they think if they play the game at all, they're going to become that Machiavellian manipulative person that they can't look in the mirror. No, that's not the truth. You're not going to turn into that individual. Another mistake I see a lot of people making is they try so hard to work on the relationship and communicate with that person and reach out, and they kind of do it to death. And so if someone feels like they've done everything possible, you know, to work in a productive way with that kind of master manipulator, I say just step away, give up, give it a rest for a while, and instead try to understand who in the organization do they respect and who are they influenced by, and build great relationships with those people, because sometimes that manipulative person starts to see that and recognizes you as a key player, a real influencer too, and at that point in time, their behavior might turn around.
So it's not necessarily good just to try to get them fired.
See,
that would be my instinct. How do I get rid of this person?
No comment on that. Well, and you know, someone with such power and influence in such an extreme format, if there is a way to build them into an ally, they can be a real powerful force for good if you can kind of step alongside them and neutralize the negative aspects of their power in some way.
Well, are there times where you should just give up on the environment and say, this just isn't the right environment for me, it's not positive, and I just should go find another place to work?
Yeah, absolutely, especially if that person's your boss. Nora Denzel, who's the interim CEO with Outer Wall, just tweeted this great quote a few months ago. She said, having a bad boss isn't your fault, but staying with one is. And I think that the same goes for being in a bad work environment. You know, you can only do so much to fix it, and ultimately you're not getting the most out of your career, your company is not getting the best out of you. If you're truly in a bad situation, cut your losses and leave. And again, back to the women that I coach, I see them stay too long in a bad situation, whether it's out of fear or loyalty. And if someone is truly suffering, well, you know, why? Why keep suffering? Why not leave, cut your losses, and see if you can get into an environment where you are appreciated and valued, and you get stretched to grow and challenged. And of course, it will be like night and day when you get
back. You can really feel the difference when you're in a good environment. I'd say leave. Leave in hordes. Leave. <Yeah. laughs> So that those people have to change or die.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so and that's the only way we're really going to make progress anywhere and become a better business community is for people that just the good people leave the bad environments and, you know, force those companies to either change or not be competitive.
Yeah, it's time for everyone to hold hands and just take a leap of faith and leave those bad environments. And my goodness, they would their business would take a turn for the worse so quickly.
It would, yeah. And think of how much better.
Start a movement.
Well, and think of how much better business would be if you just refuse to be in those really bad environments.
Yeah, exactly.
But isn't there something to be said about not being a prima donna and having to, deal with a certain amount of it? You don't want to be a person that leaves all the time, but you have to know, be wise enough to know when it's a bad environment and when it's just you just not being able to deal with normal stuff.
Yes, indeed. And so if I may, back to this idea of building some leadership skills around office politics. And so whenever I ask someone to identify someone that they really admire who navigates office politics really well, they describe in glowing terms these leaders who have somehow created kind of a positive bubble around themselves and they're able to navigate effectively. So I pulled out a little research, and this comes from Florida State University, and what they found is there's actually a competency called positive political savvy. So you can decide not to ignore politics and also not turn into that type of individual you don't want to become, but you can build the skill of being positively politically savvy. And it's kind of a combination of four other skills: social astuteness, interpersonal influence, networking ability, and sincerity. So, you know, it's not necessary just to up and quit and leave. Do give yourself the option of starting to build some of these positive political leadership skills and see if you can make an impact on the environment around you.
Well, that's just really great advice. How can people get hold of you if they want to book you for a conference, or do you just do leadership training for executives, or how does it work?
You know, I split my time fairly evenly between delivering webinars, which are fairly low cost, and hopefully anyone, you know, can afford out of their budget. I also go into companies and do training for the emerging women leaders on how to advance their careers. And then the rest of my time I spend speaking at professional conferences, either leadership conferences or a lot of the women's professional conferences. And so kind of split my time up between the three. But so I would direct people to my blog, which is beleaderly.com. So beleaderly.com, where you'll find articles and tips and resources and videos, just a lot of resources on the types of stuff that we've just discussed. And, you know, if someone's interested in hiring me, of course, they can go from there.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much for joining us today. This has been really good information.
It's been great speaking with you, Sarah. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
If you want to see more from Joel Miller, you can get to her blog page at www.beleaderly.com, and you will see more information about some of the blog posts that we were talking about in the interview. And you can also go to my webpage at sarahwestall.com, and you will see those posted there as well, or on my radio page on Web Talk Radio. Now we are going to welcome Paul Rosenberg to the program.
Hi, Paul. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
You have a quote from your latest article that says, "I see an increasing number of people who are markedly better than the world around them." What do you mean by that?
I see a lot more people, interesting, both old and young and in between, who are more kind, more caring, who give a damn, who want to know what's true, who want to live a better way. I see an increasing number of them. You know, it's always hard to gauge exactly. We only, you know, any of us can only see just a small fraction of the world. But I've been around a while, and I've seen a lot of people, and I'm seeing more and more of this now. And I take it for a very good sign.
You think it's just our world cycling back? You know, we went through a hard period, and now we're all kind of retrenching and becoming better?
You know, I'm not so sure it has to do with short-term events. I think it's part of it, at least part of it, is the fact that there's so much more information now. People are so much more informed on important things. And, you know, there's so much trash that comes and goes over the internet. If it's not wrong, it's just, you know, useless and vain and silly. Who cares about, you know, which celebrity maybe or maybe not might be having a divorce or an affair this week. You know, you can waste your life on that stuff. But along with all that stuff, there's a lot of good information coming and going on the internet, and it's gone places it never would before. I remember when I started with, I don't know what to call them, kind of liberty-minded people, freedom sort of people, in, let's say, 1990-something, the people that you would meet who really got it were overeducated types from New York or maybe Chicago or maybe Los Angeles and a few others scattered in between, and they were very analytical, you know, hyper-studious sorts of folks. And they got it, and to their credit, they did understand and they cared. Well, now they're everywhere. You got kids in, you know, Denton, Texas, and, you know, Topeka, Kansas, and Homer, Alaska, who understand the same things these hyper-studious people did in the 90s.
Well, and it's because the hyper-studious people had to find it in libraries, and they had to work hard to find it, whereas the average person now could sit on their computer and just really get engaged.
Exactly. And it's a big deal.
Well, you have a statement, too, that says humans are inherently biased. We focus probably at a ratio of at least 2 to 1 on the negative. And then you go on to say this negative bias masks most of the good that happens in the world. And right now there are millions of people who are becoming qualitatively better.
Right. Right. You know, we humans, you know, you walk through a forest and you see a shadow, immediately you don't think, oh, it's a bush. You think, oh, my God, it's a bear. And that sort of thing, you know, goes on, and it's kind of a built-in thing where, and it's, you know, in some cases for survival in the woods, it's probably a useful thing. But in daily life, we over-focus on the negative. You know, most people behave fairly well most of the time. Otherwise, we would have car crashes on every corner. So most people behave fairly well most of the time, but we notice and complain about the bad things that happen among that, and we do. We over-focus on the negative.
Well, our emotions get involved, and the negative hurts us more, and so that's what we focus on, maybe.
Right.
There's a really cool video by a statistician in one of the Scandinavian countries, and he does, I think it's 200 countries in 200 years and 4 minutes. Have you seen that video?
You know, I'm not sure. I've seen something like that.
It's amazing. It's amazing. I have it on my website at sarahwestall.com, but it's a, it basically shows 200 years ago where we were as a community of humans on the planet from a health and a wealth standpoint and where we are today. And it's all based on statistics. And you watch the balls move up this chart. And
interesting.
It's amazing. And it puts things into perspective as to how far we really have come as a human race.
Oh, well, we've come a long way. You know, right now we're going through a very difficult period just because, it's a long involved story, but rulership is hitting the end of its cycle and it's going insane. And there are real serious risks involved with that. But long term, we're golden. If we can get through the next however many years the insanity is, whether it's 20 years, 40 years, whatever it is, we get through that, we're golden. We're in really good shape.
Well, and this is what I'm writing a book about, is this very topic, where it's this wealth of information, and it's almost like a storming period, right? Where we're going through this storming period in the world. It's kind of like in a business where you put change into an environment and the group goes through the storming period before they can normalize and things can just kind of get back into, you know, people are all fighting for their powers and they're figuring out where they really belong and everything else. And once that all settles out, then there becomes a new higher level of performance. And it's kind of like the Renaissance period went through that same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
So it's a big deal. Yes.
Yeah. It's when we have huge advancements in every field. I mean, we're just really going far. And I thought a lot of what you talk about kind of points to that.
Oh, absolutely. You know, where people really are getting better. The contrast is we have people who are, I don't know how to describe this properly, they're moving into, you know, the Star Trek era, and the systems that rule them are from 5000 BC. And, I mean, they really are. They're the same basic systems ruling people with fear, ruling them by convincing them the theft isn't theft if you cloak it in a cape. And this is the great conflict, because we have people who are becoming better, and the systems that coercively, you know, rule them are getting worse. So where is it going to break and how does it break?
Exactly. And it gets to that power struggle, right? They're having this fear and figuring out how to maintain their power when the world around them is changing.
Right.
But you write a lot for Casey Research, which is personal freedom through financial freedom. I love that slogan because it's all about how do you create personal freedom. And do you believe this is your goal in what you do? Or is it broader or different?
Yeah, it differs. It differs a bit. You know, Casey Research has been, you know, very nice for me. Doug's an old friend. The other guys who run it, David and Olivier, are friends. They are more of an investment or a speculation sort of company. They've done very, very well. They asked me to write a blog over there. I had one anyway, and they asked me to move it over, and it was really very nice because they have a much bigger reach than I had, and it's really been a very pleasant, nice partnership. I don't really focus on investments or things like that. I'm more concerned with history and philosophy and science and things like that.
Well, you call yourself an adventure capitalist. What does that mean?
Yeah,
it gets to that, right?
Right, it gets to that. And really, it's a funny thing. You know, people think, oh, venture capitalists. No, I'm not a venture capitalist. If I had, you know, $100 million in a bank account for projects, I wouldn't tell anyone. But
you don't want people to know because you'd be bombarded, right?
And then also I'm a private guy. If I had that kind of money, then I would use it, but I wouldn't be telling people. But what I really do is I have companies that I care about, and I have things that I do that I care about. It's not really about money. I mean, we all need money for, you know, buying food and all the usuals, but I do things that I think matter, that I care about, and that I think matter to the world. You know, my two things that I work on now are primarily Crypto Hippie, which is, you know, gives people actual privacy on the internet, and Free Man's Perspective, my newsletter. And, you know, I want to make money with them. I do make money with them. But, you know, I really want to do them because I love them.
And you state that your passion truly lies in writing for Free Man's Perspective. I saw that quote somewhere. And
yeah,
does that get – go ahead. Is that an old quote?
Really. it's not too old, I don't think. That's really number one to me, because I want to understand. I want to know. I want to know why the world works. I want to know how it works. I want to know what makes people better. I want to know what makes myself better. I want to do things that I care about. And the Free Man's Perspective, I get to research all kinds of fascinating things. You know, there are so many interesting, fascinating things that we were never taught in school, and that were, for whatever reasons, excluded from the curriculum, not known, just didn't fit the model. And there's all this stuff. I tell some of my friends, sometimes I feel like I'm cheating because there's all this information that's out there that just nobody knows.
Well, do you believe?
I love writing about it.
Do you believe that as you read this, it's almost like your whole paradigm changes?
For me, absolutely.
And what we were taught missed so much of what our history is, and what, I mean, we have this worldview, and it's so different than what the reality of the world is, so different than what we were taught. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, it really is. I had my breakthrough moment on that stuff was in 2008. I had gone to museums and, you know, I remember reading, you know, ancient history in school as a kid, and I went to good schools, and I was, you know, good at reading and writing, and I had good test scores and all that kind of stuff. But it made no sense. When I dealt with mathematics, I could make sense of that. I understood why. Oh, if I have this angle and that angle, well, of course, the other one has to be the difference. And in science, I could understand what made these things move and how they moved, and everything had some depth to it. When I read history, there was no depth. It was just flat numbers on a page. And as long as you could remember the date and the event of what king, you know, killed what other king on such and such a date, you did well, but there was no understanding in it. You could memorize facts, but there was no understanding to it. So for years, I struggled with that. I mean, decades I struggled with that, and then finally it came together and I understood why. And the reason is that everyone who writes history, or just about everyone who writes history, and you have to remember that it's governments who pay for all the history books, they all glorify the way of their place and time. The Romans did the same thing. The Greeks did the same thing. Their civilization, their group, is the ultimate end of history. And they really believe this. I mean, the Romans, you know, it took people 100 years or 150 years to accept the mere fact that Rome was gone. Seriously.
Yeah. Well, I've heard people say there really is no such thing as history almost, you know, as far as the books go, because everything's written from their perspective that it, loses whole context of what really happened.
Right. It absolutely does. And you need a complete outside perspective to really make sense out of history. And you can. It's not that hard. And once you see it, it's pretty darn simple. I mean, you know, there's always, you know, 10 million facts. History is hard to write because, you know,
Yes. There
are too many things going on in too many places. But once you get the model of it, it's really not that hard.
Well, what do you think about what's going on in the Middle East? This is getting off our topic a little bit, but it kind of gets to the point where we have such a us and them concept, but if we could really broaden out and really understand the world more for how it is versus just our one perspective, we would get along so much better and there wouldn't be so much conflict.
Oh, well, that's absolutely true. The Middle East, in particular, is just a royal, god-awful mess. There's so many fingers and so many pies. There's so many backroom deals. Whatever you hear on TV is false. Whatever is reported by, you know, the talking heads is false. This is all mixed up propaganda. There are people spending billions of dollars a year to influence opinion, particularly just in the United States. There's billions of dollars being spent to influence opinion. You know, it's just a royal mess for the Middle East, and sadly, I don't see any quick end to it.
Well, is it possible for our media to be able to you know, say truth, or is it just there's so much money involved that it's just not going to happen?
Well, you know, it is possible. You could have independent media, and we have a fair amount of it now.
Sure.
Where people, you know, tell the truth. Big media, forget it. They're done. They're going to be what they are until they crash.
And it's simply because there's money behind it, and the people want the people with money. It's just like when you have an marketing campaign and you're trying to sell your product, you don't want bad things talking about your product. It makes sense if you can think about it that way. It's just when it becomes bigger geopolitical reasons and all that other stuff, it kind of skews what's going on. But right? I mean, it's not going to, yeah.
Mm-hmm. When organizations of whatever kind reach a certain size and reach a certain level of arrogance, they don't reform. You know, you could see these people at the end of the Roman Empire, and they're basically decent folks, and they're trying to fix the thing, and they're trying to reform it, and they're going to, you know, it's the same thing we hear now. Oh, but once so-and-so gets out of office, it'll be better. And once we get so-and-so into office, it'll be better. But these kinds of systems, including big media, they don't repair once they pass a certain point. And it's just they're going to go and they're going to be what they are until they crash and burn. And then, of course, no one will have seen it coming.
Well, I had a university professor tell me once that the beginning of someone's downfall is when they become arrogant. Arrogance causes the beginning of the downfall.
Well, that's a pretty good general statement, yeah.
Yeah, and you, if you don't get past your arrogance, then you know, the other thing is, you know, you see a lot of people in business that are very, very arrogant running their company, and what happens a lot is you either go out of business or you just plateau.
Yeah, or, you know, what these guys end up doing. You know, we used to talk about the three generations of businesses. The first one is the guy who starts it off. He's the entrepreneur. He works his butt off. He does this. He, you know, provides good service to people. And then, you know, he hands it off to maybe his kids who just try to consolidate everything. They don't want to go through the effort that the old man did. They just want to, you know, have a boat and do this, and they consolidate it. And then if it makes it to the third generation, then they go after sweetheart deals. And they pay people off, and then they buy fundraisers for politicians in return for goodies, and that's what we're seeing in corporate America now.
Well, it kind of makes sense because the entrepreneur has all those basic, you know, values, right? And so they teach it to their next generation. So the next generation doesn't want to work as hard, but they don't. But they have been exposed to those values. But that third generation hasn't been exposed to those values.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they end up those businesses end up just, you know, doing the corporate thing, which is, you know, you hire lobbyists, you buy politicians, you get laws written the way that works for you, and you make a lot of money on it. And as the end result of it is all the mom and pops get squeezed out, which is exactly what's happening now.
Would you think there will be a revival of mom and pops, or do you think this is, you know, with all the information and all the learning and all the things that's going on, do you think there sort of is a revival of mom and pops on the internet and people searching out different ways, or do you think that just the large corporations will, that's the way it is for eternity?
Well, no, not for eternity, thank God. But for now, in mainstream culture, that's it. Mom and pop are squeezed out. The corporations are taking over. Their, you know, local stores are, you know, just gone. And, you know, if it was that way just by honest competition, that'd be fine. But what really lies at the root of most of this is that you're a big corp. You can buy the regulations you want. And mom and pop can't buy the regulations they want, and they can't protect themselves from regulations. So they get killed and they get squeezed out. I talk to small businessmen all the time. I mean, these are my friends, and they're, you know, Paul, it's just not fun anymore. We have to get a permit for this, and we got to get something for that, and they come and inspect us and want more money out of us for this. I told my kids not to get into it. I want to get out. It's not fun anymore. I mean, this is what I hear all the time.
Yeah, it becomes very difficult to be successful as an entrepreneur without playing the game the way they want
right.
you to.
Right, you have to buy politicians, you know, one way or the other, however you want to describe it. But that's essentially what you're buying access. You're getting protection from the rules or getting the rules written your way, and that's the new way of doing business. And it sucks.
Well, the big businesses are out. They know that they're not good at creating businesses, so they're out buying all the smaller businesses.
Right, right. And, you know, so it's a real problem. The small businesses are surviving on the fringes and in the loopholes. And, you know, heck, that's what I do. I used to employ people. I won't do it anymore. It's not worth it. It made my life miserable. Screw it. I'm out.
So you try to make money and do things more as an educator and as a free thinker and trying to get people to think differently.
That's a big part of it. Yes. I mean, I still have, you know, I wrote for major publishers for years and years, and I still do a little business with them. I used to do expert witness work, and I still do. I'm not doing it this year, but occasionally I still do some of my old stuff too.
You're an engineer, right, in your training?
In my training. I'm not technically. I'm not officially an engineer with a proper stamp, but yeah.
Oh, that's so funny, the stamp. Well,
it's true. It's a big deal for engineers.
Well, I know. I have an engineering degree, but mine's more computer-oriented, and the stamp it's not as big of a deal in the computer industry.
Okay.
But, yeah, so I know that it's a big deal for regular engineers. Wouldn't you think that with businesses and the way that I'm seeing it, it's kind of like the everyday products that you need. You kind of want to buy from just the most inexpensive source possible. But
right.
For things that are, you know, so it makes sense. It's a service to the community to have a really efficient, production chain and everything else. So to get your products that just are everyday things. I don't care. You know, I want a clean window cleaner that doesn't hurt me, but I just don't want to pay a lot for it. You know, the things that you don't care about. But the things that
sure.
you care about and the niche things, the things that you're really into, those are the small companies that are growing because the big companies just don't do them well.
Yeah, and that's true, and that's good. But put it this way, my fear is that they are going to get more and more squeezed out. They have something good and they'll be bought up by the big companies or squeezed out in one way or another because the big companies have a predatory advantage.
Yes,
they can get rules written their way. They can deal with, they have 55 lawyers on staff. You don't.
Yeah. And a small business owner can't pay $5,000 an hour for the team of lawyers that's needed to go against them.
That's right. It's absolutely right.
Yes, I know. It is absolutely right. So you claim that you've written about the business of government, how it works and how profitable it is. Can you give us an overview of how profitable government really is?
Oh, it's astonishing. Their revenues are off the charts. And it always has been. You know, I in the newsletter, I traced it back to, you know, like 6,000 BC. And the revenues are just off the charts. Look at it this way. Take wherever you live, the neighborhood, the subdivision, whatever the area is where you live, and count up, just make a guess at how much money is made by all of the people who live in that neighborhood. And it's quickly into millions. Depending on the size of your neighborhood, it might be many millions. And think about that, and think about government gets half of that. Every year, every week, every month, they get half of all that money. Now, multiply that times the rest of the country.
And you just wonder,
it's ungodly.
And you just wonder where it's going, because I don't see it going towards my services.
Well, no, you're a productive person, and you're somewhere in the middle, and the guys in the middle get creamed. They have to get creamed. The system is designed. You know, we talk about the middle class. I think productive class is probably a better way to say it these days. But whatever. People who, you know, have regular jobs, nurses, carpenters, whatever. People who work, the system is designed to bleed them dry. That's the way it's set up. If you make $10 million a year, you can hire, you know, lawyers and set up all kinds of offshore trusts and foundations and everything else and, you know, buy loopholes and protect your income, protect your wealth. If you're, you know, very, very poor, they protect you on the other side. The guys in the middle get creamed, and that's the way the system is built. And don't kid yourself, they know what they're doing.
Well, do you think you almost have to have more than $10 million now, though, to really make a difference? I mean, you're talking even more money than that, right? Or do you think the $10 million is still enough to be able to buy things out and secure your wealth?
Oh, well, there's all sorts of ways to do it. You don't have to go that big. You have to find the loopholes that exist. At least they exist now. You can set up offshore corporations and offshore structures for probably $5,000 or $10,000. But you have to have the courage to do them. You know, ultimately, we talk about money being necessary, you know, or helpful for freedom, and it is helpful. But ultimately, money really isn't the thing. It's what's going on in your head.
Oh, absolutely.
And yeah, I mean, money's a wonderful tool, but it's just a tool. And if you're not free internally, you're never going to be free externally, no matter what kind of money you think you got.
Well, that gets back to following your passions. You got to do what – I don't even think you can make good money unless you follow your passions. I suppose you can, but it's
– Yeah, I mean, if you're a Coke dealer or Wall Street, yeah.
But in general, if you don't follow your passions, it's very difficult to make a lot of money.
It is for a healthy soul, yes.
Yes. So where does the government spend all their profits if they have such a healthy amount of profits?
Well, essentially it goes to their friends, to the people who buy legislation, who buy the campaign parties, let's say. I mean, of course, they're buying legislation in the end, but let's do it the nice way that are political donors. There was just a great study that came out last week or maybe 2 weeks ago that somebody tracked the 200 most politically active corporations in the United States, and they found out that for every dollar that they donated to politicians, they got $760 back.
Oh, what a great investment.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Well, that's the way
investment.
The system works.
Yes. So give us, can you track one? Like, give us an example of what somebody would give and, you know, company would give and how it works through the system and then what they end up getting. Just to give people an idea, you know.
Fine. I'll give you examples from from my past, you know, before the age of majority, so I can't be held accountable. My dad was a construction contractor. And it's, as soon as I got to be 16 years old and I got my precious driver's license, I was put to work delivering bribes.
And, oh, wow. you were right in the middle of it.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, here, go take this. Take it over there. Don't ask no questions. Give it to them and tell them who it's from, okay? All right.
Where did you live?
I was 16 years old. I got to drive a nice car with an FM radio.
where was this? What part of the country?
Chicago, of course.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, every place else isn't that different. New Orleans may be worse. But anyhow, I delivered all kinds of stuff to people in return for contracts. I went to political fundraisers. You know, I was told I would wear a suit and I would have this envelope and I would wait in line and talk to the politician face to face. And say, hello, this is from such and such, and we thank you very much. And he, you know, the politician acknowledged it, took the envelope, shook my hand, and told me to enjoy the buffet. and in return, contracts were granted.
And you would just give them a check, and it's like a donation check, essentially?
Right. It was a proper, legal, you know, political donation.
Did you deliver bribes that weren't legal? Like you just go deliver a bribe that was...
Leather coats to so-and-so's wife and, you know, stuff like that, sure.
So you did the gamut. But back then it was easier. I mean, you still had to fit in the legal channels more than today because now they have all those... you can donate to the political action, you know, funds or whatever they're called. And so they can give... They could give $100 million in one chunk to that fund, whereas, you know, back then you could only give $1,000 or whatever it was, legally.
You know, the rules change all the time, and I'm not entirely up on them. But you're right about PACs; you can give a heck of a lot of money to them. But you know, the people that I knew, they liked to do a one-on-one and personal. With the people involved, you know, hey, how's it going? Did your wife like the fur coat she got? Oh, isn't that nice? Well, listen, I got something I'm going to send over to you next week. You know, maybe we can have lunch and talk about it afterwards. You know, that kind of thing.
But behind the scenes, son, go deliver this.
Yeah. Oh,
but
yeah.
Be nice.
And I was told, you know, shut up, go meet the nice lady, give her the box, tell her who it's from. Smile. If she invites you in for a cup of tea, say, thank you very much, madam. I can't come. I have to go. Say, I got to go somewhere else. I'm on a schedule, but thank you very much. And you will smile and you will be polite and she will like you. Okay.
Well, and you know what? They've done a study in that older women, grandma types, or just women in general that are, you know, have children and things. They like young men.
You know, I'm sure they do. Yeah.
Yeah. They just see it as so, you know, sweet.
Mm-hmm.
All
they
innocent.
Did.
Yeah, I'm sure. So, you teach people to see the world as it is. How do you see it? And I know we've already been talking about this, but summarize this more. How do you think the world is different than what we see in the media?
Well, again, the history and also the official culture, if you will, of the place in time always presents that place in time is kind of the end of history. We're the enlightened ones. We know the way the world should be. We're living the high life. We're the ones who know. And if nothing else, you never say anything against the culture of your place in time. And that kind of thing is very deep. And again, you know, all of us or most of us go through this, schooling system from the time we're 4 or 5 till the time we're 18 or 22, where it's designed that way. And to be very honest about it, the bills for it all are paid for by local government units or federal government units. So they will never say anything to contradict the people who pay their bills. And, you know, Alvin Toffler wrote about this in the late 70s. People wrote about it before him even. But let's be real honest and say that public schooling is at least half conditioning because it really, really is. Toffler wrote about it, and he's talked about the overt curriculum and the covert curriculum, and he was dead on accurate.
Well, would you say it's changing a little bit? Because I know that when I was growing up, and I went through a public system, me and the people around us, we thought we were superior to everyone. I mean, to every culture, to everybody. We just really,
right.
It was just known. It was just understood we were superior. But today, I'm not sure if people think that way anymore.
Well, that's a really good question, and it's hard to keep track of. It is breaking down a bit. Unfortunately, there's a lot of politics mixed in with a lot of it, and politics makes everything ugly and makes everything confused. It may be breaking down a bit. Actually, it is, but it's hard for me to tell exactly where and exactly how. But this idea that, we're it and we're the great ones and, of course we didn't do anything wrong. We being, the United States, in general, i.e. the U.S. government, we wouldn't do that. We didn't do anything wrong. Oh, yeah, I've got these pictures from Abu Ghraib. What do you think about this? Did we do something wrong? Do you want to send your daughter to torture school? Is this a good idea? those things are coming around. So you're probably right. It's just hard for me to get a good grasp of it all.
Well, and I'm wondering if it's just because we have so much access now to people of other different, the internet and the merging of social networks, where we have so much access to people with different cultures and the alternative media,
right.
and we're just seeing things differently. And maybe it's not the masses that are. Maybe it's just, like you said, you're seeing more and more people that are learning and seeing things differently. And maybe that's what I'm seeing.
No, your point is a good one, because you can have, years ago, let's go back, let's pick on the guys about 300 or 400 years ago. It was real easy for the boss man, prince, whatever he was, to, stir up trouble. The people on the other side of the hill, you know how they are. Oh my God, they're this, they're that. Or, let's go after a perennial victim, the Jews. They're not us, they're different. They're going, we need to, and rulers always love to have an enemy because it takes heat off them and it's real easy to stir people up that way. Well, it's not so easy, as you say. It's not so easy anymore. Oh, gypsies are all no good, says Grandpa. Well, grandson says, Grandpa, there's a gypsy kid I talked to on the internet, and he's a nice guy. I like him. So, grandson isn't going to be so quick to, drive the gypsies out of town.
Yeah, people are becoming critical thinkers, and they're thinking about it and saying, wait a minute, that just doesn't make sense to me. And it kind of comes across when Obama wanted to go to war against, in the Ukraine, he wanted to put, he couldn't do it. He ended up figuring out how to do it. He's going to,
Syria, they tried real hard to get a war. Failed.
Well, yeah, the people were against it.
Yeah.
And he went to the government and it just didn't work.
Right. They tried hard to stir up. They had all kinds of advisors there. Of course, ISIS and whoever they are ended up getting the weapons. But, they tried hard to get something going in Syria and failed, which was, made me very happy.
Well, he was embarrassed, I'm sure, of that. That's what's leading to all of, he's having a hard time doing what he wants in general, and he's figuring out a way to get around it and make it happen differently. But the people are against it now. They don't want to go
right.
to war anymore.
There was a great little thing from the 60s. It was a poster and buttons and everything else. And it said, what would happen if they gave a war and nobody came?
Well, who wants to go? I don't want to send my kids to war. I don't want my kids to die. I want to know that the cause is just, and we're thinking and we're not being stupid. And let's figure out ways to be diplomatic about it. And if you're just going in to be a force and just a brute force, try to figure something out, and you're not even on the right side, I'm not sending my kid to war.
Right. Absolutely. They can, as they say, go pound sand. My kid's not going there to dodge bullets for what? What was the point? What was the point of Iraq? What's the difference over there now? Saddam was a bad guy. Of course he was. He was a monster. So, if that was your real concern, just, go send some special forces and take out the monster.
Yeah.
What was the point of Afghanistan? Is Afghanistan better than it was? Is Afghanistan ever going to be a modern, enlightened nation? Not anytime soon.
Well, and there's the sad part is there are people internally that are really fighting for it. And I think we actually, you know, we could have went in, we could have helped those enlightened people in different ways and really made a difference, but we didn't. And it's actually worse now than it was well, I don't know about Afghanistan. Afghanistan was pretty bad back then too, but.
Afghanistan's a disaster. I was actually there once. It is a flaming disaster.
It's pretty bad, but. Yeah. If we're not going to be competent, then don't send our money and our troops and our kids to die. It's just like business. Oh, if you're not competent, don't do
home.
It.
Yeah, they got boys and girls coming home with, you know, missing limbs and dead, and not to mention all the people there who get shot up and you know, droning, you know, weddings and funerals. It's a disaster.
Yeah, if it gets back to the same point. If you don't know what you're doing, if you're not competent, don't do it. Get out of the way. Well, after with Iraq, they put people in charge. You know, you read about the stuff. They put people in charge. The United States completely screwed it up. And we did worse after than we – I mean, we were pretty good at taking them out. Yeah, we're good at that. But we were so – awful at managing it afterwards that we created more of a mess than what was there before. And
I think that's probably true. It blew my mind that they just didn't have a real plan for what to do when they got in. I mean, the Pentagon has a plan, you know, what happens if North Dakota invades South Dakota? And how could they not have a plan for this? But it looks like they actually didn't.
Well, but you know, it was so immature, it was so dumb. I mean, so we are so good at being a military force, taking them out, but we're so childish and, you know, so it's like you're a kindergarten student and in your understanding of how to deal with the after effects. I mean, they hired a person just out of college to run the whole infrastructure part of Iraq, you know, stuff like that. That was just so dumb.
Yep. It's crazy, and you have to conclude that they really don't care. That it's you know, they put on a great theater, they put on a great show, they show their smart bombs taking out buildings, we show the firefight on CNN, and our brave American soldiers with flags and anthems going and everything else. But you know, they got what they want out of it, and they really don't care about how can you put a college kid in charge of all this stuff. This is supposed to be a gray-haired man who's, you know, 60 years old and has done everything.
Well, or somebody who's really thought hard about it, somebody who understands the culture, understand what the ramifications are of doing, you know, such a thing. I mean, these are serious consequences. And if we spent all this money to solve a problem, then let's go solve it. Otherwise, don't screw around. You know, it's don't do it. Solve it.
And this isn't a joke. You know, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dead people. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of injured people. You know, soldiers who come back and, you know, this rah-rah military stuff really ticks me off because I've known too many people. You know, they come back, they're not the same and they're not better. They're worse.
Oh, yeah. You know, they feel that it's a sacrifice. And I understand a sacrifice for the good of our community. We're being attacked. We need to protect our freedoms. We're being attacked on so many different levels, whatever. We need to protect ourselves. But this, then you better be good at it and you better know what you're doing. And because people are going to get hurt and a lot of people are going to get hurt. And if it ends up being worse than when we started because you're incompetent, then that's not okay.
Well, very definitely not. Yes.
Okay, well, let's move on to your golden age. So now that we talked about that and you did that rant.
That we over-focused on the negative.
Let's get back to the positive because you said, 2-1, negative versus positive. We got to get our one in there. You believe that we are in this great golden age. Why do you believe that?
Well, more properly, I think we're coming into a golden age. But the reason I believe it is a real simple one. Well, it's, you know, I'll give you the basic one that's real simple, is that scarcity is dying. If you look at long-term charts of prices of commodities, but prices denominated in average daily wage. Julian Simon did the real work on this, and his assistant, really, Stephen Moore, who now works for the Wall Street Journal, has done some more on it as well. But if you take, let's say, the price of wheat denominated in average wage, it is a straight course down. And it's been going down for 100, 200 years, and it's almost at a very low plateau. If you look at the price of copper, if you look at the price of coal or all these other commodities and measure them in daily wages or average wages, it's a straight shot down. So what you get for working for a day is way, 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 way up from what it used to be. And scarcity is dying. It hasn't shown up in the culture yet. And this is really another great conflict. Scarcity is dying, but there's a problem. It's in that humans are addicted to status.
Oh, yeah.
And if scarcity dies, well, if everyone has a Lamborghini, then you're really not, you know, proving anything to cute Susie who lives down the street by driving a Lamborghini.
Have you ever seen that little cartoon with Dr. Seuss where those creatures have a spot on their belly, and the ones with the spots are better than the ones without the spots? And
then I think I remember, yeah.
And this guy comes to town. It's such a great story. This guy comes to town with this machine that can put spots on your belly.
Uh-huh.
So all the ones without spots goes to the machines and gets a spot stamped on their belly. Next thing you know, the people with the spots are looking around and going, oh, my God, I got to do something. So they go through the machine, too. Now they get two spots on their belly, and two spots are better than one spot.
Yeah.
And then they go through, and then it eventually becomes a point where it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter anymore because you can just go buy your spot. And that's the concept.
Right. That's actually a really good analogy for where we are now. Because scarcity is dying. I know a guy who writes for the big newspaper in Pittsburgh, and he made a point one day. He says, you know, I went to go visit my daughter, and he says, I thought about it on the way. I'm flying in an airplane. John D. Rockefeller could never have done this the way I do it, not in the time I do it. I live in almost every way that matters, the quality of the food I eat, the quality of medical care I have, the quality of transportation I have, I'm way better off than John D. Rockefeller.
Oh, yeah. And that's what I was saying about a car. I was talking to my husband about this. It's like, well, do we really need to get the nicest car? Because the cars now that are just for the masses are nicer than the nicest car 10 years ago.
Exactly. So what we have is people going after replacement scarcity. I've got to have whatever, a Bentley. I've got to have this. I've got to brag that I did this or I did that. And, you know, it's a problem because a lot of our mating strategies are built around that. I'm a better athlete. I'm a better this. I'm prettier. I'm, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah, it is our mating strategy. I mean, that is how we get together as, you know, a marriage.
All too often, yeah. And it's very, very common. And so this idea that scarcity is dying, and it's a real problem. People are scratching after replacement scarcity. You know, but what happens when it gets further? What if, you know, when we have the happy sci-fi future where we have everything done at the push of a button, or the, you know, just say the word and your dinner appears, how are people going to find meaning? How are they going to mate? How are they going to do all of these other things?
It gets back to quality of character then.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And so that's the golden age, right?
Once we get past this transition period, which could get very damn ugly, it could get a lot uglier than it is already. But once we get past this transition period, humanity has a golden future.
Well, so how can people take advantage of it? Let's finish up with how can we take advantage of it? What do we do?
Oh, boy.
Be calm and patient and get enlightened?
Stay away from the big trouble. Stay out of, I mean, this is the stuff I write about every month. You know, understand what's going on. Stop wasting your time and energy reforming that which will not be reformed. Start building what's new and better. Get busy. Pick something if you like, whatever, 3D printing, if you like Bitcoin, if you like something that's out of the system that's doomed, get out of it. Do something different. Find something. Get active. Yeah, you're going to make mistakes here and there. Of course you are. So what? You're going to make mistakes inside the system too. Adapt, overcome, work on new things, build the new world. The example that I love to use is the fall of the Roman Empire. It was going down. Anybody who really wanted to know knew it was going down, but they really didn't want to think about it. They kept trying desperately to reform it. And the people who just stepped out of it and said, you know what, it's no good. We're not going to play. You do your thing. We're going to do ours, were the early Christians. And they're the ones who survived it and built a new culture in Europe.
So your message, that's a great example as well. Just get busy doing good things.
Yes.
Make a difference.
Do things that you think are right and start doing it and ignore the mass of the world that's kind of devolving into an ugly furball.
Well, that is very inspirational. So that's a great way to end this on the one positive, the 1-2 negative ratio. So thank you so much for joining us today, and I really appreciate it. And people can go to your blog where?
The best places are freemansperspective.com, just the way it sounds. And then the service that we run is cryptohippie.com.
And that helps people be private on the internet.
Yeah, all the stuff that Snowden revealed, that's the stuff that we protect people from.
Okay, that's a good service.
Okay. I think.
Yeah. Okay, well, you have a wonderful day, and thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
I like the quest to be positive that Paul has. We all tend to be more negative than positive. And I think if we can try to be more positive, we will solve more problems and just be happier. So I like the fact that he's really trying to focus on that. And that would help me a lot, too, because we all tend to be negative. But if you want to reach more of his stuff, you can go to the Free Man's Perspective. He has a blog there. He also does a blog on Casey Research, so you can reach him in multiple places. If you just Google Paul Rosenberg, he comes up, and you can see all sorts of stuff that he has done. So for now, have a wonderful day.